Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm sorry about the handout. So before to preempt heckling from Professor Meller, the handout is that long because there's lots of text on it. And you may or may not wish to be looking at the text. It's shorter than it would have been because I deleted all the Greek because I thought that might not be such fun. Okay. I'm going to read this paper because otherwise there is not a snowball's chance that I would get finished in time so that Hugh doesn't bang a gong at me. So I will do my best to do it right so that the other Hugh does it. Okay, starting with death and disagreement. At the centre of Plato's dialogue, the Euthydemus, lies a sequence of arguments about the workings of speaking or saying or statements about, in Greek, legein and logoi. Occasionally will slip into Greek, especially for logos. I mean logos, not logos. My daughter's taught me how to say that word, but that's not the word I mean today. The sophists notoriously persuade their interlocutors to agree to three claims. They're all three on the handout. Firstly, this is killing Cleinias. In wanting Cleinias to become wise, where he's now ignorant, Socrates and Ctesippus wish him dead. Secondly, falsehood is impossible. Thirdly, disagreement or counter-saying, the Greek is antilegein, is impossible. The denial of falsehood and of disagreement is deployed by the sophists to rebut Ctesippus' rejection of the first claim that he wishes Cleinias dead. There's a subplot here. So Ctesippus, who's really very hard to say, is in love with Cleinias, who's very pretty. So a lot of this gets a bit heated at times. I'm not going to talk about the heat. Okay, so the connection between the denial of falsehood and the denial of the possibility of disagreement and the killing of Cleinias is fixed by the overarching programme of the dialogue to find a protreptic to philosophy for Cleinias. The end of that protreptic is to make him good, not just clever, but wise and virtuous as well. So not only in terms of Socrates' interests, but also in terms of what the sophists seem to have agreed to provide, there is a link between Cleinias' moral development and his changing. And that change is here treated as a death, as the replacement of the old Cleinias with a new one. This claim, which so upsets Ctesippus at the time, is itself underpinned by the pair of arguments that follows it, the arguments to deny falsehood and disagreement. It's those arguments which imply the impossibility of moral development or of becoming wise. And Socrates, to be able to turn Cleinias towards wisdom, badly needs to rebut what the sophists say. So all of this stuff seems to offer us sophistry at its most extreme. But can Socrates or we rebut the arguments? Without offering proper grounds for resisting what the sophists invite us to conclude, neither we nor their interlocutors are entitled to reject these unsavoury conclusions. And of course, if the conclusions are right, it's hard to make sense of resisting what someone would say anyway. Consider the last argument in the sequence, the denial of the possibility of disagreement. Dionysodorus, who's one of the dodgy sophists, there's two dodgy sophists in this, Dionysodorus and Euthydemus, and they're indiscriminable. So you have to work quite hard to keep track of which one's which. So the argument goes like this. There are logoi that belong, logoi as in sayings or speakings, logoi that belong to each of the things that are. A logos belongs to each thing either as the thing is or as it is not. No one says what is not. No one says things as they are not. So each logos belongs to each thing as it is. If two people both say a logos of the same thing, that is in Greek the same pragma, they say the same thing and don't disagree with each other. If neither of two people say the logos of the thing, neither of them has the thing in mind and they don't disagree with each other. If one person says the logos of the thing and the other another logos of another thing, they don't disagree with each other. If one person says the logos of the thing and the other doesn't say anything at all, they don't disagree with each other, and Ctesippus at the end of this argument is silent. Okay, the argument is E on page 2 of the handout. Ctesippus' disagreements are stopped, and so is his power of speech. Should he have something to say? Well, Dionysodorus' argument trades on a quite specific and restricted sense of logos, of speaking, as what is said or stated. Logos is a statement or a speaking. Statements or speakings have content, describing what they're of. This is their thing, their pragma. This thing they are of, on the sophist's view, fully determines the content of the statement. So the of relation between logos and pragma, between statement and thing, is, as I shall say, exact. It's exclusive, exhaustive, and fully determinate. You might at first find this plausible. So if I say Peregrine pushed the pumpkin, because it's Thanksgiving this week, so thinking about pumpkins. Or else I wrote this during Halloween. Maybe that's what it was. Okay, so if I say Peregrine pushed the pumpkin, my statement on this account is of Peregrine's pumpkin pushing. But if the of relation is exact in the sense that I'm just using it, then only what my statement is of can be its truth maker. So Peregrine pushed the pumpkin, in quotes, if it's indeed of Peregrine's pumpkin pushing, will be true of it too. Anything different, Peregrine poisoned the pumpkin, perhaps, will just be of something else, and so irrelevant to what I said first. If there's an exact correlation between a logos and what it is of, then the logos I speak or say will correspond exactly to what it is of, whatever that is. And what it is what makes it true. Then, individual logoi must either replicate each other or talk past each other. In that case, disagreement is indeed impossible. Whenever I do some speaking, I speak what I speak of the speaking's object. And this is kind of getting silly, isn't it? Okay, and that object just is what I do my speaking about. Equally, when you do some speaking, you speak what you speak about. Sorry, you speak what you speak about your speaking's object, and that object just is what you do your speaking about. If speaking is like this, Dionysodorus takes us to agree just when we speak or say the same thing. When we say something different, we're talking about different things, so disagreement is impossible. This argument, I'm sorry it was so swift, this argument tells a story about logos. The relation between a logos and its object is a one-to-one correlation, the exact fit between what is stated and what it's stated of. So I call this inevitably chopped logos. The relation between a logos and what it is of, first of all, is exact, that is to say, exclusive, exhaustive, and determinate. Secondly, the relation between a logos and what it is of is truth determining, since each logos is chopped according to its pragma, according to its thing. This account is a realist one and cheap at the price because it explicates both truth and meaning. If both of those two claims are true, that is A and B on the handout under chopped logos, there are no interesting relations between logoi. So in particular, we can talk about this, but I think it's important. In particular, there are no truth functional relations between logoi, and there are no higher order relations between logoi. I think that it's possible that there might be that for either case, there could be tautologies, but I'd be very grateful to talk about that at some point during the discussion. Okay, so those are the conditions for chopped logos. Notice something else. This discussion between Socrates and the sophists turns in part on what it means to speak, on the meaning of the words legein, that's the verb, and logos, that's the noun. The sophists' arguments must treat these words as univocal to resist refutation. A logos is a statement, single and atomic, and resistant to the complex relations of truth, functionality, and order. The correlate verb, legein, is equally determinate. Moreover, that verb will not display differences of tense and aspect for fear of falsifying the statements in question. Speaking is exact and essentially present and immediate. Chopped logos, then, is suitable fare for killing Cleinias. So chopped logos is clearly indigestible, but how are we to get it off the menu? If falsehood is impossible and disagreement is impossible, there is no such thing as a counter-argument. Any argument will simply miss its target. So on the sophist's own terms, they can't be refuted. If their opponent insists on trying to refute them, she can only do so by assuming what they deny, and so by obstinately begging the question against them. This will leave the sophists unscathed, and it will leave Cleinias without philosophy, or maybe just dead. It is, of course, an old problem. If someone attacks the basic principles of philosophical argument, how, without relying on those same basic principles, are they to be refuted? The basicness is important. The principles in question are taken by one party to govern all discourse, but denied in the same terms by the other. This, I think, makes trouble for Socrates. Three times in the dialogue, he attempts to show that the sophists face self-refutation, either of their logoi. I find my own way through my handout. Okay, I'm now on page three. Three, Socrates' problem. And that's then a list of the self-refutations. Okay, so three self-refutations. The first two are refutations of the logoi of... Sorry, first three, first two, 286c, 288a, and the third one is of those who speak the logoi. The first self-refutation seems to go like this. The sophist's logos, by applying to the logoi of others, applies to itself. The sophist's logos, by applying to other logoi, silences the other logoi, so the sophist's logos silences itself. Or of those who speak the logoi, the sophist's logos, by applying to the logoi of others, applies to the sophists themselves. The sophist's logos, by applying to others' logoi, silences the others, so the sophist's logos silences the sophists themselves. These short arguments must assume that the sophist logos, in this case the argument by which they reduce their interlocutor, is a logos in just the same way as any other. Because by applying to other logoi, it applies to itself, and so self-refutes. The expression logos, therefore, must be treated as univocal for the argument to go through. The sophists concede univocity, but they deny that any chopped logos applies to any other, so the self-refutation never gets going at all. Their response to the objection is rightly to remain silent. The self-refutation contrariwise insists that some logoi are able to apply to other logoi. If this doesn't beg the question against the sophists, it seems at least to use logos, or speaking, in different ways, at least higher order wise in expressions like the sophist's logos and chopped in the logoi of others and itself. But then does Socrates cheat? For the first premise, right, that's one in both cases, in both A and B. For the first premise, either he needs both sorts of logos, both higher order and chopped, and then he equivocates, behaving no better than any old sophist. Or he simply offers a flat denial of chopped logos and no argument at all. After all, if logos is chopped through and through, the argument collapses. Only if logos is not chopped can it apply to itself and to others. And the sophists deny that that's the case. Okay, so would Socrates understand the complaint that he equivocates? Would he understand what it would be to equivocate? Well, perhaps he would, and exactly in this dialogue. For it's often claimed that central to the euthydemus is the diagnosis of ambiguity and equivocation, the discovery that words may have more than one meaning and that arguments are vitiated if the meanings of the words don't remain constant throughout. Such a discovery, it's regularly claimed, is a major weapon in Socrates' armoury against the sophists. And all the worse, then, if Socrates exploits it in the self-refutations, Socrates' problem just got more pressing. Okay. Here is where it's said to turn up. Early in the dialogue, the sophists induce Cleinias to agree twice, both that it is the ignorant who learn and that it is the wise who learn. Socrates consoles him, right? These are the knowledge arguments, so page 4. And again, I've given you all of the texts rather than filleting the arguments. You just have to take my word for it that I'm telling you what it says in all those words down there. Okay, so sophists induced Cleinias to agree twice, both that it is the ignorant who learn and that it is the wise who learn. And Socrates consoles him. Cleinias shouldn't be amazed at these arguments, unfamiliar as they are, for he doesn't see what's being done to him. To resist them, Socrates says, Cleinias needs to learn the correctness of names, the orthotesonomaton in Greek. But even this, which Socrates attributes to Prodicus, this skill, will not get Cleinias what he really needs, the proper understanding of the way things are. Well, first question then is, what is this Prodican skill in the correctness of words? And does Socrates have it? Does Socrates want it? In those arguments that I've given you, in all those great big fat bits of text, there are lots of things that we might think go wrong. There are times, for example, when there seems to be a shift in scope or some kind of compositional mistake. So, for example, there is in the second and third arguments, you might think that what we're being asked to think is that we know the letters but not the words in a dictation. So the mistake is about whether we know the words just because we know the letters, and that's a puzzle that comes up elsewhere in Plato. So that maybe that's some of what goes wrong. There are times when the arguments seem to trade on a contrast between a disposition, this is in the first argument, a disposition such as being clever or quick at learning, and a process, that is to say, beginning to learn or being in the middle of learning. But the appeal to Prodicus may suggest something about, as I was suggesting, ambiguity. Socrates offers us in his diagnosis, which is my section 5, the example of learning. The arguments of the sophists, he suggests, turn on ignoring the distinction between acquiring knowledge, that is to say, learning, and understanding, having learned. And Socrates suggests that the Greek word, the Greek verb manthano, stands in for both of those things. So what is he complaining about? He may be suggesting that the verb to learn is used of two quite different mental processes or states, learning and understanding, and that it's just equivocal, used in of them in such a way that there's no substitution of one use by another in transparent context, salva veritate. His advice, therefore, to consult the correctness of names may be advice not to be caught out by such ambiguity. The lesson we learned from the sophists would be, then, a lesson in linguistic practice. Such a lesson would have ramifications, of course, if learn is being used in two quite different senses or with two quite different meanings, and if Socrates is made to call our attention to that, Plato would need to have some kind of grasp of the meaning of meaning. And while we might be asking just what that grasp would involve exactly and why it might matter, a different diagnosis is available. I'm glad that David Sedley is here, because David first suggested this to me 25 years ago and I've been worrying about it ever since. So I think here is my version of cracking what you suggested in the seminar on that particular occasion. So I think one of the things one might instead say is that Socrates is distinguishing between two different aspects in the grammatical sense of learning. So he's distinguishing between the imperfective, that is to say, the endeavour of learning, in English, I learn, in Greek, manthemo, versus the perfective, the learning that one has when one's learned, I have learned, or I am learned. In Greek, actually, manthemo, but also past tenses, in the aorist past tenses. The contrast is not straightforwardly a difference in sense between the two expressions. Instead, for learning, the grammatical difference of aspect reflects a difference in the process, in the context, in the circumstances in which I find myself. When I talk about what I know and understand, what I learned, and what I'm trying like mad to comprehend, what I'm still continuing to learn, or when I deny that I'm ignorant, when I say that I'm unlearned, but concede that I haven't yet learnt the lesson, well, I'm still unlearned. And just those differences reflect stages in the process of learning, stages which are obscured by the paired arguments of the sophists. Yet some of the difference between these two expressions had better not be a difference in sense rather than a difference in aspect. Because if they were, the endeavour that I undergo when I learn won't reliably issue in what I aim at, namely learning. The shift from one aspect to another in the course of an argument is not perhaps an equivocation. It's not perhaps a failure to get to grips with the lexicon. It might be a failure properly to conjugate or to parse the expression in question, as when the difference in aspect is marked by what is often wrongly taken to be a difference in tense. In Greek, the difference between an imperfect tense and an aorist. But the problem may instead be a failure to put the expression in question within its proper context. So I learned when I went about acquiring understanding. I learned when I completed the endeavour. This is what learning is like. Those failures may affect whether or not a particular sentence comes out true. But once the context and the grammar, and even in this case the epistemology, are sufficiently taken into account, there shouldn't be any risk that within an argument there would be illicit shifts of meaning that fail to preserve truth. On this account, Kleinias fails fully to consider the state of affairs to which some sentence refers, rather than merely failing to grasp the meanings of words or falling victim to an equivocation. This diagnosis fits well with Socrates' contrast between the play that goes with the correctness of names and the seriousness that goes with the things, the pragmata. In the first, shifts of aspect may escape unnoticed. In the second, we apply to the things the way they are, and here differences of aspect should be inescapable in a serious investigation of context or in a serious account of process and change, accounts which are challenged from the beginning of the dialogue to the end. Of course, even differences of aspect, as the sophistic arguments show, may behave as ambiguities, because differences of aspect may fail the substitution test. When I say that I'm learning Latin or philosophy, I can't mean by that that I have completely learned them. Otherwise, my first lesson would be my last, and some of us would be out of a job. So in some sense, Socrates' response to the sophist does disambiguate, but it does so by focusing our attention on something important, on the complexity of the nature of learning itself and of its processes. And then if we generalise, we may see that there's a great deal more to be said about the things that correspond to the words than is allowed by an exact, sophistic account of language, of truth, and of meaning. Okay, if Socrates shows up the differences of aspect in the contrast between learning and learned, and if this figures in the contrast between words and things, and if this is not designed to be an account of ambiguity or equivocation, then he will need to give an account of just how different aspects are coordinated in relation to a single thing or pragma. For the contrast between aspects is itself theory-laden. It depends most strikingly of all on the thought that there can be aspect change, something that corresponds to the changes in a verb when a process such as learning occurs, without the process collapsing into distinct and separate episodes. Killing Clinias, the sophists suggest that any change in Clinias gives us a new Clinias, so that to wish him changed is to wish him out of existence. For Clinias, there is no such thing on this account as becoming better. All he can hope for is a better future self, and even that's quite difficult to parse. Against this, Socrates needs to insist that there is some continuity between learning and having learned, such that the aspect changes describe different parts of the same process. This defence needs to occur, moreover, at the level of metaphysics rather than language. Socrates needs to show that there is such a thing as process and continuity and development, rather than a succession of new and distinct events. Well, what would that mean for the case of knowing or learning to be good? Socrates might say, for example, that the thing in question is knowledge itself, and that the differences in aspect, that is, in coming to know or knowing, or learning or coming to have learned, are simply differences in the relation that we bear to the thing at its core, knowledge. So there's a kind of blobby thing, and somehow or other the aspects are controlled by how near or how far we are to it, whether we've got a little bit of it or what. This might connect to aspect differences most of all if we think about knowledge as a fat sort of thing, right? So if you think about knowledge not as being P and then Q and then R, but some big sort of structure or blob or whatever image grabs you for that fat science. So it's a fat science, or it's a body of knowledge, or it's understanding as a whole. That might be one way of thinking about how the aspects get controlled. Or perhaps the thing in question, the thing that we need to figure out as having some continuity, is a general property such as being knowledgeable. And the change of aspect in the verb learn reflects differences in the ways and the extents to which we possess the property knowledgeable. So here the aspect change focuses on the changer, that is the agent, we need to think about it like that, the agent undergoing the process of the subject, undergoing the process of acquiring that property. In either case, the pragma, the thing, would be broad enough to capture the concept and determinate enough to avoid the possibility of equivocation. And certainly this dialogue does offer us some such account of why we should learn and how. The process must be serious. I mean, serious in the sense that this is actually the funniest, you may not think so now, but it's the funniest of Plato's dialogues. You may feel, nobody falls off chairs as they do in the comedies, but it's otherwise in lots of other ways. It's kind of, well, I think it's funny anyway. So the process must be serious, and it must engage properly with the way things really are, rather than just play at competition in argument. But learning the way things are is somehow integrated. Socrates wants to find not only consistency, there is in the dialogue a defence of why consistency matters. He wants to find not only consistency, but knowledge, the one thing that is good itself by itself, the one thing that is worth aiming for. Sarah was talking about this last week. It's the sovereign good, knowledge, on the account of the Euthydemus. This wholesale knowledge, this sovereign knowledge, reasonably enough, is not to be acquired easily nor quickly. Witness the case of Ctesippus, who by the end of the dialogue has discovered nothing except how to imitate the sophists, and his last utterance is despairing. He says, I give up. And indeed, even Socrates doesn't know how to get there, even if he does have an account to give of how to start. And see his reflections on Meno's paradox, one of the great moments in Greek philosophy, Euthydemus 293-7. But this process is both coherent, that is the process of coming to know, learning, is both coherent and important, a process that is directed at the only good, knowledge, and it is this process that frames and determines all the individual discussions and arguments of the dialogue. But now consider the character of learning as it's thus described. Crucial to all Socrates' demands is their normativity. We should engage on this process and in the right way to the right end. Learning on Socrates' account is to be understood teleologically as an action or series of actions or even a lifetime's endeavour to an end where the nature of the end and the nature of the person aiming at it jointly determine the norms that apply to the endeavour itself. The learner decides to learn, learns and has learned all with the same aim and all under the description learner, the knowledge that is acquired by learning. And that knowledge, as I said, is the only good itself by itself. That means it's at least good in itself and probably also constitutive of the good of anything else at all. So the centre of ethical explanation on this account is wisdom, and becoming wise, it, however the argument is constructed, is central to the best life. That's why the protreptic to philosophy matters. There is, and there must be, so going back to Socrates' account of what goes wrong with the sophists' arguments about knowledge, there must be for this teleological structure to make sense no ambiguity here, but rather a familiar teleological structure. That structure is determined by three things: the object of the endeavour, that is, knowing how things are, the subject of the endeavour, that's the person who aims to learn, and the endeavour itself, effective learning. Each of these will constrain differences in aspect in the verbs we use. But notice that this teleological structure implies that the aiming may fail. I might try like mad to learn quantum mechanics and fail at the first particle or wave. It is, we might say, built in to normativity that sometimes an ought didn't. So the teleological structure also accounts for where claims to learn may turn out false. And this, I think, matters. Just quickly coming up to the end. Am I all right for time?
5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay. High speed. Okay, so does this account of the teleology of learning bear on Socrates' problem, which was about speaking? I suggested that this turned on whether Socrates gets it wrong by equivocating on logos in the self-refutations. Does the normativity stuff help with this? It's common ground to Socrates and the sophists that to speak, that is, legein, is an action, and that speakings are somehow or other related to some corresponding things. The sophists declare, and Socrates and his friends seem to agree, that this relation is the truth-telling relation. For the sophists, this relation is one of equivalence. If and only if I speak, what I say is about the thing in question and true. For Socrates, the relation is a teleological one. If I speak, what I say is directed at the thing in question, and so truth-directed. This truth-directedness has further features, in particular that it's truth-functional, so it's liable to falsification if it implies a contradiction. So what I say is affected by its relation to the other things I say. This may be a requirement objectively, but it's a requirement subjectively too. For if when I speak I aim at the truth, then I might be worried or anxious lest what I say turns out to imply a contradiction or to commit me to an inconsistency. This is a psychological phenomenon which both Socrates and the sophists observe over and over in this dialogue, whatever their diagnosis. And it's a phenomenon that's essentially reflective. The psychological effect of unease at a threatening contradiction has a contradiction in its express scope. So I worry that P and not P seem true at once. Consequently, if when I speak I aim at the truth, my speaking may also be reflective on how the things I say are or can be themselves the objects of further things I say. And that's just what happens. The interlocutors obsessively go over and over what they've said and what it implies and where those implications leave them. This reflectiveness is not merely empty or vain, but it works to check and check again the relation between what I say and what I aim at, namely the truth. So speaking on this account is extended, continuous, and responsive to questions just because what it's directed at is something complex, a body of truth like a body of knowledge rather than just a single claim, not P or not P. And this reflectiveness has an outcome for the subject. Not only do I try to speak the truth, but I reflect on whether I'm doing so, and I commit myself to the result of my reflection when I speak or revise it. So this reflective commitment is the subjective or psychological dimension of aiming at the truth. It's manifested in a running theme of the dialogue, the responses of individual speakers to what they say. They agree, disagree, fall silent, but throughout the dialogue itself ensures that what they say is interconnected, reflective, and committed. And if that's so, disagreement is possible. I think I'm going to skip very quickly just to think about whether the self-refutations are equivocated. Have I got time to do that quickly? Okay, so what I'm claiming then is that speaking, like learning, has changes in aspect in exactly the same way as Socrates points out for learning, and that it's to be understood normatively. Does this account of speaking do what it needs to do, and is self-refutation then possible? I suggested that we've got two accounts of logos here. One is sophistic chopped logos, and the other one is this logos theory of Socrates, which is continuous, reflective, and it's further contextualized in conversation. The sophistic view chopped logos can block self-refutation by denying that there are any relations between logoi, but the Socratic version of logos allows the self-refutation to go through by legitimating the reflective and communal relations between logoi, and by allowing that we can say things that are false without falling silent. Normativity allows for failure. So his self-refutation is not, I claim, equivocated. There is a question about whether actually it's just pointless, whether he's saying something that the sophists just won't hear. Socrates supposes that there are normative constraints on speaking, as I've suggested. This isn't just about getting the rules of the saying game right, but about why we should join the game at all. The question isn't self-contained. It's not a question that can be answered by appeals to principles of logic or of language. For it, like Socrates, like the Sophist challenge to Socrates in the first place, asks about the basis for those very principles. You might think that the teleological account is to be understood simply instrumentally, but I think that there's a much broader claim here. If you think that that Logos on Socrates' account is an account of a whole life, and that that explains the teleology, then you can see that what you have on offer here is two completely competing notions of what it is to engage in discussion at all. If the Sophist chop logos theory is true, it's a consequence of that they are as piecemeal as their logoi are. The continuity and the community of a life well lived is just not available to them. They are, as the dialogue suggests at the outset, freshly minted each time they speak. The self-refutation is correspondingly indirect. Without allowing for the aspects of speaking, they cannot be said to speak at all. Thank you.